Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. Coming up on the show, of course, we'll be talking with K.T. McFarland, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. John Gizzi will join us from Newsmax, Cheryl Atkinson from Full Measure, Jennifer Harper from The Washington Times, and Jim Trusty, our legal expert, all on the way on the Saturday Morning Update. Something happened overnight in the Ukraine conflict. There is a bridge, or there was a bridge, between Crimea and mainland Russia. It has been partially destroyed in an apparent Ukrainian strike. An explosion on the rail section of the bridge was reported early this morning. Footage from the scene later showing a train of oil tanker wagons were ablaze. One lane of the parallel road bridge had collapsed. In one video, a driver parked near the blaze was heard saying on the phone, "I'll be late. The bridge is on fire." No reports immediately of casualties. A Russian-appointed local official said a fire had broken out on the oil train and that it was being extinguished. Vladimir Putin ordered construction of a bridge across the Strait of Kerch following that annexation of Crimea in 2014. It was two auto lanes and a railroad bridge. It was reportedly a very prestigious project for Vladimir Putin, and the reports are that this is a humiliating blow. And again, fuel tankers on the railroad train on the bridge exploding. One other note on Ukraine this morning, they have now been keeping Russian troops on the run in the south. They've actually recaptured 2,400 square miles in the south was held by Russian troops. Want to turn to the United States. Now, what's going on in politics that affects you this weekend? We could talk about polls around the country. We'll talk about a couple of them, but we're not going to spend a whole lot of time because we're still a month away and we know the polls aren't particularly reliable. So we'll strike that from the project this morning. We could talk about Hunter Biden. We'll get into that in a few minutes. It's worthy of discussion. But what impacts you? When was the last time you went and filled up the tank? Remember how President Biden recently had told us that the gasoline prices were coming down? They'd come down like every day for weeks. And have you been to the pump recently? Well, they're on the way back up. Now, you think it's bad around the Washington area. How about Pennsylvania? You know, Pennsylvania, you get out in the countryside in Pennsylvania. Well, a member of the Saturday Morning Update Field Investigative Unit, a little facetiousness here, anyway, got a call from somebody who was at a Sheetz station in Ephrata, Pennsylvania. Now, Sheetz is not like Sunoco. It's not like Shell. It's that place you go in, you get coffee and a couple of donuts while you're there. Anyway, at the Sheetz station in Ephrata, the regular was $3.55 a gallon on Thursday. Now, that's hardly under $3, President Biden. Remember all the promises that the president has made, how this was such a priority? If you don't remember, we'll refresh your memory for you.
I'm doing all I can to increase the supply for the United States of America, which I expect to happen.
I'm using every lever available to me to bring down prices for the American people.
I have a plan to bring down the cost of gas and food.
I'm doing everything in my power to blunt Putin's price hike and bring down the cost of gas and food. I led the world to coordinate the largest release of global oil reserves in history.
How can you possibly be proud of leading the largest release of global oil reserves in history? Are you crazy? The whole idea for the reserves is you have them in case of an emergency. You don't deplete them. You're not proud of the accomplishment of depleting the oil reserves. He's depleted one-third of our oil reserves so far. And now OPEC is cutting the barrel production by 2 million barrels a day. And he's proud of depleting the reserves globally? Whew. Now, what does all this mean? Well, they're going to cut back on the production. So instead of turning to the American oil producers, we're looking at Venezuela, led by the dictator Nicolas Maduro, who is not exactly a friend to the United States. Now, a little concern here. You remember the president went over to the Mideast, met with the Saudis, and there was some hope in that trip that maybe he would work something out for future oil production. Peter Ducey asked this question of Corinne Jean-Pierre.
When the president went to Saudi Arabia, he said, "I'm doing all I can to increase the supply for the United States of America, which I expect to happen." What happened?
So I want to be very clear, and we have said that, you know, his trip to the Middle East was not about oil. It was about America's position.
About America's position? Well, America's position isn't real good right now because we don't have any oil. These people, I don't understand these people. I'm sorry. How do you feel about where we're going on the oil situation and your gasoline prices? Now, I'd like to hear some confidence from the administration. I'd like to hear somebody come out and say, here's where, you know, we're going to handle it this way, and I don't want to hear about depleting more of our oil reserves. I want to hear about a strategy. So let's hear what the president had to say about a strategy.
There's a lot of alternatives. We haven't made up our mind yet.
In other words, we don't know what we're doing. Let's ask the same question of Brian Deese, the National Economic Council Director.
We continue to look at the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is one of those. So, you know, we're not announcing any steps on that front, but there are measures that we will continue to assess as we go forward.
In other words, we don't know what we're doing. He took 17 seconds to say what he could have said in a handful of words. We don't know what we're doing. And did you notice the habada, habada, habada as he was going through it? So he's the director of the National Economic Council. He doesn't know what we're doing. So nobody in the administration knows what we're doing. But I will remind you that we can put our total faith, trust, and confidence in Jennifer Granholm, the Secretary of Energy. She will save the day, I am convinced. Well, how does John Thune feel about this, Republican from South Dakota?
Pulling down the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to the lowest level literally since 1984, a reserve that's there for emergencies, and using it for a political purpose is outrageous. They're putting not only our energy security at risk, our national security at risk. Why can't they give licenses to companies in this country so we can start producing American energy? I mean, that's the whole essence of what this issue is about, the fact that this administration, when they took office, started an attack on American energy production.
Now, you noticed he mentioned in there the politics of it. Now, think about this. We're releasing the oil reserves now a month from the elections, so we want to bring the gas prices down. So we're going to bribe you with lower gas prices until, of course, the week after Election Day, when we're going to stop the oil reserves because we're going through them so fast, and then your prices at the pump are going to start to go up again. But nobody's mentioning that. So number one, we're going to deplete the oil reserves so we can bribe some voters. Number two, we released all of the marijuana violations that were held in federal prison. Now, one of the legal experts that I heard this week mentioned that if you're in federal prison on a marijuana charge, you probably did something worse, and this is kind of how they worked it out. Instead of charging you with the higher crime, you ended up with a marijuana violation in a federal prison. Normally, you don't go to federal prison for just having a little pot in the glove compartment. So that's another one. So let's see. We're going to take care of everybody who likes marijuana. We'll go ahead and bribe them. And that's just a couple of the things going on out there, not to mention, how about that student loan debt? Why don't we buy everybody that has student loan debt by releasing $10,000 or $20,000 if you have the Pell Grant? So no politics involved in any of this to try and salvage the midterms. None at all. Now, you may have seen the clip of President Biden over a week ago now when he was trying to find the congresswoman who had been killed in an auto accident. And this is not funny at all about that, but he was attempting to call her out. And of course, she was not in the room. Well, Saturday Night Live did a thing on something slightly different, but related to it. And I don't know a lot of people that are watching Saturday Night Live anymore because of the politics of Saturday Night Live. But they did come up with a good one here. So this is Saturday Night Live, and this was the season premiere last week. And this is a response to that situation where the president was calling out for somebody who had recently passed away. And here's how Saturday Night Live cast it.
President Biden on Friday attended a formal ceremony welcoming Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. Said Biden, "And where's Justice Ginsburg? Ruth, come on up here."
So even Saturday Night Live is waking up to some of the weaknesses of the Commander-in-Chief. Oh, my. 6:20 now. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Maryland on the Beltway, right now no crashes or construction in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. Inner loop and outer loop are clear and at speed. In Montgomery County on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, you're not tapping the brakes on the northbound side or on the southbound side. Now in Prince George's County, if you're traveling between the two Beltways on 95 or the BW Parkway, I have no reports of any delays north and south. On Route 50 in Prince George's County, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, no delays being reported on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and through the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight 40s and 30s. Some frost once again, a possibility off to the west. Mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraff in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:22 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, and President Biden has claimed heritage that surprises everybody. And this past week, of course, he mentioned the Puerto Rican heritage. There was an interesting headline on the story. Biden is actually Greek and Jewish and raised by Puerto Ricans. That from the Washington Post in the first paragraph. President Biden, to hear him tell it, is as Greek as Poseidon. He was brought up by both the Puerto Rican community and the black community, and he's more Jewish than Jews. The words of the reporter in the Washington Post. So we take you to President Biden, and it's just kind of amusing how he comes up with this stuff. Remember, he also drove a truck as well. So this is President Biden this week with his Puerto Rican heritage. And as you listen to this, I want you to keep in mind that in 1970, the Puerto Rican population in Delaware was 0.39%. In 1980, the Puerto Rican population in Delaware had soared to 0.81%, and today it is at 3%, those stats from the U.S. Census Bureau. But here's how the president was raised by Puerto Ricans.
We have a very, in relative terms, large Puerto Rican population in Delaware, and so I was sort of raised in the Puerto Rican community at home, politically.
I'm sorry. Where does he come up with this stuff? All right. Well, Mayor Adams has an issue, obviously, with the immigrants who are being flown and bussed in from Texas. He's not happy about it. And here are his comments from Thursday this week.
The far right is doing the wrong thing and the far left is doing nothing. I mean, everyone needs to be in this game. Everyone should be on all hands on deck. Everyone. Not sitting back and throwing rocks. A rock is not a plan. Everyone should be on deck helping this crisis right now.
So that's Mayor Adams. Let's take you back to September. Now, this was before the buses and the planes started arriving in New York. So here's Mayor Eric Adams on CNN in September.
I think that they should come to any place in the country that they desire their pursuit of the American dream.
Okay, so he was real happy and welcomed everybody back in September. Here's how he felt about it yesterday.
New Yorkers are angry. I am angry too. We have not asked for this. There was never any agreement to take on the job of supporting thousands of asylum seekers.
What a difference a couple of months makes. He wants $1 billion in funding, emergency relief funding. He's declared a state of emergency in New York. He wants $1 billion to fund it. Take the numbers in New York, a few thousand, and then you look at Texas, where it's a few thousand a day. How is Texas supposed to handle thousands a day when he wants $1 billion to handle a few thousand in the state of New York? The hypocrisy is stunning in all of these cases, and I'm preaching to the choir, I'm sure, because I think you realize it. If you listen to WML, you probably got some smarts. But the stuff they try and pull over on us is just amazing. It is 6:25 now. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. As I mentioned, we got Jennifer Harper coming up next. We'll talk to Jim Trusty within the half hour, our legal expert, and get an update on the Trump Mar-a-Lago situation. We have also got John Gizzi coming up. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. Cheryl Atkinson is on the way, as well as KT McFarland. So do stay with us. In the news at 6:30, Russian authorities say a truck bomb has caused a fire and the collapse of a section of a bridge that links Russia-annexed Crimea with Russia. The bridge is a key supply artery for Moscow's faltering war effort in southern Ukraine. The Speaker of Crimea's Kremlin-backed regional parliament immediately accused Ukraine, though the Kremlin did not apportion any blame. The White House says President Biden's warnings that the world is at risk of nuclear Armageddon were meant to convey that no one should underestimate the extraordinary danger if Russia deploys tactical nuclear weapons in its war against Ukraine. President's grim assessment sent ripples around the world on Friday, also appeared to edge beyond the boundaries of current U.S. intelligence assessments. And soldiers are leaving the Army National Guard at a faster rate than they are enlisting. It is fueling concerns that in the coming years, units around the country may not meet military requirements for overseas and other deployments. Officials say the number of soldiers retiring or leaving the Guard each month in the past year has exceeded those coming in, for a total annual loss of about 7,500 service members. 6:31, it is the Saturday morning update. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Good morning. Starting in Virginia, I looked at the traffic cameras around the Beltway. Didn't see any crashes, and I don't have any reports of any construction being set up yet on the inner loop or on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, no delays on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. Now to 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. Northbound and southbound, you're not tapping the brakes. Lanes are clear there. And in D.C. on 295, 395, and 695, no delays are being reported on those three. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and through the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight 40s and 30s, some frost once again a possibility off to the west. Mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraff in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:32 on the Saturday morning update.
Live and local.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update. It is good to have you with us, and it's always good to have Jennifer Harper join us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
A lot of talk about possible presidential candidates in 2024 on that Democratic ticket. Apparently Joe Biden sort of leaked it out to Al Sharpton that he was planning to run again, but he might get a surprise from somebody we know quite well.
Well, yes, indeed, and that's somebody from his own past, and that would be Michelle Obama. And let's talk about some of the pointers and indicators that she might be considering an eye at the White House there. But anyway, she has a new book coming out in a matter of weeks that is called The Light We Carry, Overcoming in Uncertain Times. And, you know, it's one of those big, long books, et cetera. But she's going to have a grand national tour. This is what it's being described as, with an all-star lineup. This is according to Live Nation Entertainment, and perhaps a lot of our listeners will remember that they are the people that are behind all these huge musical tours and so forth. Well, anyway, they're handling her tour, and she's going to go to 14 major cities. Some of the people that will be on stage with her are Oprah Winfrey, of course, David Letterman, Ellen DeGeneres, Tyler Perry, quite a few. They're all going to be appearing, and they're going to be in the role of moderators on stage. And Mrs. Obama said in a written statement that I got a hold of, she said, for me, the book tour will be about starting important conversations and digging deeper into the questions that all of us are grappling with as we live through uncertain times. Well, anyway, her publisher, Crown, that's an imprint of Random House, and they reveal that the first printing of this book, Rick, is 2.75 million copies. Think about that. That's a huge amount. There's going to be an audio version. There's going to be a film version of her tour around the country for the book. And also it's going to be published in 14 languages in 27 countries. But anyway, there has been some buzz out there in the news organizations about the possibility that Michelle might run for president. But I think the most important headline came from The Hill, and they said, Michelle Obama, Democrats 2024 break glass in case of emergency candidates. So that's where we stand with possible another President Obama.
Well, you talk about 2024. It's all about messaging in politics, but a lot of questions about the Democratic messaging. And do they really have any messaging at this point that's consistent?
That's an incredibly great way to put it, because a lot of people think that not only they're off message, they just may not have a message at all right now. And one of the best summations of that came from New York Post columnist Michael Goodwin. And he says, this is very straightforward, he says, poll after poll shows that inflation, the economy, crime, and immigration are at the top of most voters' lists. This is bad news for President Biden and his party, because they have no answers for any of these problems, most of which they created or allowed to fester. And time is not on their side, with signs suggesting everything could get worse before Election Day. And this is coming from Michael Goodwin. He says, in that case, their only hope is the shiny object theory of politics, which involves trying to distract voters' attention from the core issues. And so at every level, Democrats are campaigning on Donald Trump, January 6th, and abortion. And that's coming from Michael Goodwin. Interesting summary, I thought.
A lot of attention being paid to polls for the 2022 midterms. And, you know, when it comes to polling and things, they talk about voters, yada, yada, yada. But I guess you asked the question in the column this week, who are American voters really?
Yeah, really, who are they? I mean, just like Mr. Goodwin mentioned, Democrats may not have a message. They also might not know who the electorate is. But anyway, this is a YouGov poll that came out this week, very contemporary, September 24th to 27th, that was conducted. And it found out that 31% of Americans say that they are moderate. Next, 19% say their political viewpoint is conservative. 16% say their political viewpoint is liberal. 13% are not sure what their political viewpoint is, but moving along, another 12% say that they are very conservative, and another 10% describe their political viewpoint as very liberal. And the takeaway on that is the conservatives have an edge here, and certainly moderates and conservatives are fairly close to one another. And one more poll here about the Republican Party itself. They're doing pretty well as well. This is a Gallup poll that came out this week. It said 57% of U.S. adults say the Republican Party is the best political party in dealing with security issues such as our national military strength and only 37% said that about the Democratic Party. 51% said the Republican Party is better at dealing with the economy. Only 41% gave that judgment call to the Democratic Party. And last but not least, 44% have a favorable opinion of the Republican Party. Only 39% have a favorable opinion of the Democratic Party. So, again, there's an edge there, and it's a little more than just significant, I'd say.
You know, you wrote something this week that kind of made me think a little bit, and that is about journalists and where they come from, who they are, and the idea that maybe there's another area of fresh blood that we could bring into journalism.
Yes, absolutely, and there is definitely a push for that. And I'm going to be talking about a new organization called Military Vets in Journalism. And this was a group founded in 2019, and they are on a clear mission to attract more military veterans to the press. Now, isn't that a good idea in terms of the type of really visceral and vital coverage that we all listen to? Anyway, the organization definitely has a definite task at hand, because they found that only 2% of the ranks of the news media are made up of veterans. And they were citing numbers that came from the U.S. Census. That's only 2%. But anyway, they have a very substantial convention right here in D.C. this weekend, and their agenda includes disinformation and media coverage, national security, better reporting on disabled veterans. I think that's a great idea. And also local investigative journalism and discussions on why newsrooms need veterans. I think that's a pretty interesting idea. Anyway, the speakers include Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Kessling. He is actually a former U.S. Marine infantry officer who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He's going to talk to them about what veterans actually bring to journalism. If you're curious about them, this is a very interesting group. Again, it's Military Vets in Journalism. That is mjv.network. You can actually find their convention schedule and all the speaking topics right there at the site under their blog heading. So that's kind of one for the veterans, and a good one, too.
We mentioned messaging earlier. What about the progressives and a message they've got?
Yeah, they've got quite a message here, Rick, and they're calling it Nail the Vote. Well, that sounds like, you know, pretty interesting, pushy and serious and all, but actually they're talking about fingernails here. And here we go. This is according to Move On, our favorite progressive groups. They say to maximize awareness of the progressive and Democratic campaign, Move On has partnered with high-profile nail artists to create voting-themed nail art. And this is a part of their organization of trying to reach out to as many Democrats as they can and progressives as well, particularly millennial and Generation Z voters. And so what they've come out with are nail wraps. I don't really know what they are. I don't use nail wraps. But anyway, for their Nail the Vote, they have two different designs of new nail wraps that women or whoever can put on their fingernails. But they've got a very serious approach to this. They say it will give participants the chance to multiply their vote with vote tripling, a tactic proved to multiply the impact at the polls, asking them to post photos of their nail wrap designs to social media using the hashtag NailTheVote22 and tagging three friends. This is, again, according to Move On. And, yes, of course, there's a website. If you're curious, it's at NailTheVote.com.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, Washington Times. As always, thank you very much. You nailed it.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks, and have a good weekend, everybody.
6:44, Saturday morning update. Jim Trusty next, but first we head to the WML Traffic Center. Al BD is here this morning.
In Maryland, on the Beltway, in Prince George's County, and in Montgomery County, all lanes are clear on the inner loop and outer loop. You're not tapping the brakes bridge to bridge, okay? Now to 270. Between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, no delays on the northbound side or on the southbound side. back in Prince George's County. If you're traveling between the two beltways on the BW Parkway or 95, no delays been reported there. And on Route 50 in Prince George's County, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, no delays on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and through the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight 40s and 30s. Some frost once again a possibility off to the west. Mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraff in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:45, the Saturday morning update. It is the Saturday morning update. Glad you're with us this weekend. Always great to have Jim Trustee join us. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington and the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
We see a lot of speculation in the news throughout the week. We see a lot of opinions expressed about what's going on in the Trump case involving Mar-a-Lago, but it's always great to get the facts from somebody who knows the facts. And Jim, bring us up to date. You've been gracious in bringing us up to date each week on the developments in the case. So there were some reports this week. What do we need to be aware of?
Sure. Well, I'm happy to do it. And again, I have to talk about the public part, not the private part. There's plenty going on behind the scenes, and that's going to be pretty consistent throughout this case. But publicly, a lot of what happened this week centered around the idea of a filter team. And I thought it might be worthwhile just for the listeners to get a quick primer on what a filter team is. It's basically when the prosecutors are setting up something like a search or a search warrant, they'll have prosecutors and agents who are not on the case get the first look at any sort of documents, or sometimes that might be computerized documents, before anyone else on the trial team does. And that way, if the filter team, as they call it, sees any privileged materials, like attorney-client privilege, then it doesn't infect the trial team with that knowledge. It's a way of basically keeping the trial team and the case agents that they're going to use for any sort of investigation or trial from ever being disqualified. And so a quick example, not from this case clearly, but you know, what if you had a lawyer that's dealing with a tax cheat of a potential defendant, and the lawyer writes a letter saying, hey, if you get charged with tax evasion, this is how we're going to defend it. This is how we're going to win the case. You know, clearly attorney-client privilege materials, talking about the strategy, if they're ever going to get charged. Well, the prosecutor on the case should never be allowed to see that if it was seized in a search warrant. And so the filter team is basically designed to keep the prosecutor from ever being disqualified, from ever seeing something that would be a real problem with continuing on the case. Now, the problem in President Trump's case is that the filter team actually missed some documents, and they came to court and talked about that when we first appeared down in South Florida. And Judge Cannon really took issue with that. You know, the filter team came in and announced that they had done their job and everything was perfectly quarantined, but then they also acknowledged a couple of mistakes, and Judge Cannon, when she was deciding whether to have some judicial authority over the process, that certainly affected her and was part of her opinion. And since then, there's even been a little bit more of moments where the filtered process seemed to break down. In this particular case, there's a lot of privileged stuff to talk about, because you're not just talking about attorney-client and something called work product privilege, but there's issues about executive privilege, because he was the president. So communications involving the president, communications that reflect deliberation on certain issues, all of that can have a privilege attached to it as well. So that's the basics. That what happened this week was the filter team and the president's lawyers, myself included, filed a joint letter to the special master laying out what their position was on the documents that had been grabbed by the filter team. And so as it's playing out next week, they're going to give us back a bunch of personal documents, in my humble opinion, documents that never should have been seized in the first place. But in any event, we're going to get some personal documents back next week. I think it's about 380 pages, if I remember correctly. We'll have a status conference about 10 days from this morning where we talk to the special master on the phone and try to figure out kind of where we are on this process. And we're still basically waiting for the spigot to start running with copies of the seized documents that weren't part of the filter team but were part of the investigative team. So there's still roughly 200,000 pages of seized documents that are coming our way to start looking at and to start hashing out issues in front of the special master and eventually Judge Cannon on. So that's where we're heading with this case. I mean, dealing with the documents themselves that were part of the investigation and what was seized at Mar-a-Lago. And it's going to keep us busy for a while. So I'm sure we'll have more to talk about by next week.
I'm sure many people listening are familiar with your appearances on the Fox News Channel. And we've talked about the Hunter Biden investigation over the past couple of years now, I guess. And the Washington Post headline this week, a Washington Post exclusive, quote, federal agents see chargeable tax and gun purchase case against Hunter Biden. So translate that into layman's terms for us.
Sweet plea deal. That would be the quick version of that. So really what's happening is another trial balloon or a continuation of what we called a trial balloon a while back. You know, the rumors that are coming out consistently, and this started months ago, is that the investigation is going to end up with a tax charge and a gun charge. And the gun charge is an unusual one under the federal code dealing with either lying on the application or being a drug addict at the time you possess the gun. These are kind of weak sisters to felon in possession type charges. And we continue to hear that the prosecutors in Delaware are fretting about his addiction as a defense. And that is just simply absurd. And I know we've talked about this before, but in short form, when you're engaged in international money laundering, when you're involved in a pay-to-play scheme to have access to your father, when you're talking about hundreds of individual financial negotiations and transactions and movement of money through shell corporations, this is not the stuff where you can defend it by saying you were drunk or you were high. You know, it's different than a barroom fight, a single moment in time. So to hear that prosecutors are worried about that tells me that the prosecution and the defense are not really far apart from each other at all on this case. And let me just say, Rick, when defense attorneys are meeting with prosecutors before a case has been indicted, they're not saying, please only charge him with X. It's very rare that the conversation is literally only about what the charges will be. They're talking about resolving the case. So the conversations that seem to be taking place, as much as we can, you know, trust the sources that are with the Post on this, is that they're talking about a resolution. They're talking about, you know, how to end the investigation into the Biden family, and that it will involve what I would say are very soft charges. You know, you have international financial transactions. You got Bobulinski. You've got money reports by the bushel showing unusual transactions like Russian oligarchs playing millions of dollars, all of which for very dubious benefit. You know, no obvious service being rendered to these foreigners from Russia, China, Ukraine, wherever else, to pay the Biden family handsomely. So, again, I don't know all the evidence. Nobody does from the outside. But if there's a pay-to-play scheme, you'd be looking at bank fraud, wire fraud, money laundering, Foreign Agent Registration Act, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, I mean, major felonies, and you'd be looking at a conspiracy indictment. But what I think we're seeing right now is a continuation of that trial balloon from really almost a year ago or 10 months ago, which is a super sweet deal. And everyone's going to come out, prosecution included, saying he was in the throes of addiction, and that's it, we're done, it's over. And I'd expect weak charges, low sentencing guidelines, and a soft recommendation from the U.S. Attorney's Office. So to me, this is really two-tier justice at its worst when you talk about Hunter Biden. It's not, you know, to be personal about Hunter Biden, but, you know, the son of a president engaging in the types of financial games that this guy was involved in, referring to the big guy and all of the testimony that we're at least getting glimpses of in public, suggests that they are looking for a very small resolution that favors really the entire Biden family generously.
You know, sometimes we hear about frivolous lawsuits and things, and there was a headline about an Onion amicus brief, and I'm like, huh, what could that be about?
Well, it's a great story if you have the teenager maturity like I have when it comes to these things, but it's actually a real case and a real brief, but written by some of the greatest minds of parody in our generation at the Onion. There's a gentleman who is very mad at the local police in Ohio, so he set up a Facebook page that made fun of them and really came at them hard, made a lot of, you know, pretty sarcastic stories and comments about them, and it was parody. And, you know, parody is humor that's designed to sound like it could conceivably be real. That's kind of the joke, is that it's not that far off from reality. The Onion brags about how they've called Korean dictators the sexiest men alive, and that it got picked up in China as a real story. So, you know, they have their moments where parody somehow crosses the line. And maybe the most famous parody, which is mentioned in this brief, was John Milton's Modest Proposal, which was during the Irish famine, talking about eating children. And it was really a way of mocking the authorities who were not doing enough to solve the horrible starvation in Ireland. But it was very straight-laced, and it came off like it was a genuine essay and had people in arms. Well, this gentleman in Ohio ended up being arrested, spending 4 days in jail for criticizing the local police. And he went to trial on these kind of, you know, literally trumped-up charges about mocking law enforcement, and he was acquitted, as I would think he should be. Well, now he's suing, and he sued in Ohio, and the case went up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals on the issue of whether the officers have qualified immunity. It makes it very hard to sue if they have this form of immunity and they're doing things in the course of their job. He's now petitioning the Supreme Court to try to undo what's happened with the lower courts when it comes to giving the officers immunity. But The Onion decided, because it's about parody, that they wanted to weigh in. So an amicus brief is an outsider, a non-party, filing a brief as a friend of the court, amicus curiae. And it is a hilarious but serious brief. And I love the way they describe themselves, kind of tips it off. They say, rising from its humble beginnings as a print newspaper in 1756, The Onion now enjoys a daily readership of 4.3 trillion and has grown into the single most powerful and influential organization in human history. They go on, and I'll just do one other little snippet because the whole thing is just fantastic. On top of its journalistic pursuits, The Onion also owns and operates the majority of the world's transoceanic shipping lanes, stands on the nation's leading edge on matters of deforestation and strip mining, and proudly conducts tests on millions of animals daily. So this brief goes on in an incredible balance of describing how important parody is, how it's so important for free speech to lampoon authorities. And that could be a president, that could be a vice president, it could be a local police department. And they talk about how important it is, but they also dip into parody all throughout the brief. So if you have a weekend like mine where you're just kind of sitting around and reading legal things, sad as that may sound, this is a good one. And you'll get a kick out of it, and it's pretty easy to find. But again, it's an Ohio brief dealing with a local police department lawsuit, but The Onion makes it a headliner. It's a great story.
Good stuff. Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Thank you so much, Jim.
All right, thank you. Have a good weekend and a great Columbus Day.
Thank you, and you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Heather Curtis has the 7 o'clock news, and we're back with John Gizzi, KT McFarland, Cheryl Atkinson, and Tony Schaefer.